as Story Publishing presents Rebuilding the Buzz. The hiss of the espresso machine in the executive pantry is still audible when you slip into the corner of the 12th floor conference room, tablet in hand. It is 7:28 a.m. Pacific, a good half hour before most of the campus will stir, yet every swivel chair around the reclaimed wood table is occupied. Sunlight lifts over the Santa Clara Ridge, splashing across a wall of patent plaques, each one a memento from the company's two-decade sprint from garage sublet to indispensable collaborator of the Fortune 100. At the head of the table sits Maya Chen, co-founder, now CEO, her posture erect but her eyes ringed with the fatigue that can't be caffeinated away. She slides a stapled packet toward the team as though it were a medical chart delivering unwelcome news. No one needs to ask what it is. The biennial climate survey has always been the company's stethoscope, measuring the heartbeat that once set this place apart. Today, though, the pulse feels faint. You glance around. To your left, Priya Patel, the head of customer success, is rubbing the bridge of her nose. Opposite her, CTO Luis Arteaga drums a pen against the table, syncopating the silence. Everyone knows the mythology, how Maya and Luis bootstrapped a prototype in 2003, how the first enterprise client signed on in 2005, after a marathon whiteboard session that ended with pizza boxes and dawn creeping through dusty windows. The legend is repeated to every new hire, usually alongside mariachi band photos from the IPO party. The narrative has always carried a single through line: clients first, always. You shipped code at 2 a.m. because a retail bank call center in Singapore needed it live by morning. You answered Slack pings on Thanksgiving because a Midwest insurer was closing a $250 million underwriting run. For years, the 9-to-6 rhythm felt almost ceremonial. The Atrium coffee bar opened at 8:55, and by 9:02, pods of engineers were chalking sprint goals on portable whiteboards. Noon meant food truck roulette. 3 p.m. brought impromptu two pizza huddles in Project G. At 5:45, everyone gravitated to the demo theater, clients dialing in on wall-to-wall screens, applause tracking each sprint velocity like a stock ticker. Those rituals cultivated the buzz, that ambient electricity that let people work harder and still feel lighter. Lately, though, something in the current has dimmed. Engagement, once in the 80th percentile, has sagged 9 points in 18 months. Work-life balance has crashed into the bottom quartile of the industry benchmark. Voluntary turnover is now 14%, well above the company's historic single digits. The survey text comments, normally a stream of constructive nitpicks and emoji-peppered kudos, read like quiet resignation letters. You skim the highlights Maya has underlined. My 40-mile commute chews up 3 hours I used to spend with my daughter. It's not the work, it's the wall of meetings. Slack pings never stop. I love seeing colleagues face to face, but I've forgotten what 8 hours without fluorescent lights feels like. Clients get my best self. My family gets the burnt ends. The words feel heavier because they come from people whose IDs you recognize. Kareem in DevOps, Lauren in UX, Dinesh in Revenue Ops. Their backstories, Kareem's son with asthma, Lauren's relocation to a cheaper county, Dinesh's mother-in-law battling early dementia, underline how real lives collide with a schedule designed for a different decade. Maya clears her throat, and the room settles. What happened? She asks quietly, to our legendary buzz? She lets the question linger. No one rushes to speak. The habitual optimism of this group has met an ambiguity it cannot brainstorm away. You open your tablet to the analytic dashboard you prepared, colored bars tracing engagement by cohort, turnover hotspots blinking over a floor map, a time series line chart showing the uptick in after-hours push notifications. It's clear the culture is at an inflection point. The company's hyper-responsiveness, a virtue prized by clients, has begun to cannibalize the very people who make that responsiveness possible. Luis breaks the silence first. We built this place on co-location energy, and it worked. But now our engineers in Pleasanton are leaving at 5 a.m. to beat traffic, and the Toronto satellite logs on 2 hours before we do. Half the San Diego crew is on melatonin. Priya follows, voice soft but steady. Customer escalations used to feel like sprints. Now they feel like sieges. Our NPS hasn't slipped yet, but my team is white-knuckling it. Across the table, CFO Marcus Doyle flips through the report, brow furrowed. efficiency metrics still gleam, but behind them lie the mentor who can't summon patience for code reviews after 10 hours, the junior product manager muted on a 17-person Zoom, the rising star who chose a rival firm promising async freedom. Maya leans back, folds her arms. "We need fewer anecdotes and more options," she says, tapping the survey printout. "The board meets again in 6 weeks. They'll want a scheduling experiment. A real pilot, not lip service. It has to be bold enough to matter and measured enough to scale." She turns to you, a flicker of determination overtaking the fatigue. "I'm tasking our org science strike team to analyze 3 mutually exclusive alternatives. One will get the green light for next fiscal year. The rest we park. Scope it, scrutinize it, and come back with a defensible recommendation." All eyes shift in your direction. The responsibility lands with a palpable thud, but so does a familiar thrill. This company has never shied from big bets. Cloud re-architecture in 09, zero trust security in 17, the AI pivot during the pandemic. Each gamble was data-driven, executed with narrative clarity that rallied teams beyond the near horizon. Your mind starts mapping the work ahead. Hybrid cadence, flex windows, compressed weeks. Each option dense with trade-offs on morale, collaboration, client expectations, and operational feasibility. Outside, the daily bustle is beginning. A rumble of scooters docking, badge readers chirping. In here, the future schedule of 700 people hangs in the stillness. Maya rises, closes the packet, and offers the directive that will shape the next 6 weeks. "Bring me the truth, not just what's trendy. One option, evidence-backed, culture-ready, then we'll rebuild the buzz." The meeting adjourns. Chairs slide back, laptops snap shut, and the executives disperse toward their 9-to-6 calendars, which suddenly feel provisional. You linger a moment longer, running a fingertip over the faint coffee ring on the polished wood, an accidental watermark of long hours past. Then you step into the hallway, already drafting the blueprint that may rewrite how this company measures a day's work. From the hallway, you walk straight into what the team jokingly calls the evidence bunker, a glass cube lined with touchscreen walls and the mild smell of dry erase markers. 4 colleagues are already there. Elena from People Analytics queuing up a dashboard, Malik from Data Science feeding last quarter's Jira logs into a sentiment parser, and Alex, recently poached from a behavioral economics lab, unpacking a stack of research binders thick enough to double as dumbbells. The bunker hums with purpose. Before anyone can debate Tuesday to Thursday anchor days or compressed weeks, the language of morale itself must be made explicit. Morale, in a tech shop that relies on 2-week sprints and a 24-hour client hotline, is not a single dial waiting to be nudged. It is a network of psychological states and social signals that either power or stall the agility this firm prizes. Naming those beams and cross supports is the first step toward a shared blueprint when debates get stiff. You begin with effective commitment, the quiet emotional contract that unites personal identity with the organization's mission. When this is strong, people volunteer code reviews at 9 p.m. and push features that just feel right. In a world where plans pivot quickly, that extra pulse of ownership keeps velocity on track. Next is social cohesion, woven by pair programming, hallway jokes, and helpful glances that transform rough pull requests into collaborative triumphs. Psychological safety, Amy Edmondson's well-known concept, undergirds both. Without it, no one confesses to skipping 3 edge cases to hit a deadline. Perceived fairness keeps the structure level, ensuring promotions, work allocation, and meeting loads don't tilt cynicism into the room. Finally comes energetic vitality, the opposite of burnout. Where commitment speaks to loyalty and cohesion to connection, vitality is fuel in the tank. A cunningly placed break or remote day can do more for defect rates than the newest project management plugin. Without vitality, no camaraderie survives the grind. All 5 constructs can be measured, and for this pilot, they must be. The engagement index in the climate survey targets 3 of them. Sociometric badges can sample face-to-face interaction rates, approximating cohesion. Malik's Slack thread analysis may catch subtle tensions that signal cracks in psychological safety. Even vitality, though it sounds subjective, surfaces in the sleep quality data from the company's voluntary wellness app. Precision here is vital because the board does not sign checks based on vibes. if morale is the dependent variable, three local realities threaten to distort the read. Time zones come first. The firm spans Vancouver to Toronto, with rented dev capacity in Guadalajara, and Singaporean clients expecting real-time updates. The extra sprawl steals overlapping hours and squeezes all-hands meetings into inconvenient slots. Any study claiming big engagement gains from flexible work must address time zone spread or risk misleading you with single-zone findings. Next, sprint cycles. 2 weeks is the pulse of Scrum ceremonies. Stand-ups, demos, backlog refinements. Research showing morale lifts from asynchronous schedules could fizzle if it ignores the delicate pacing of Agile. Last, the firm's client entanglements. 40% of revenue flows from co-development deals with enterprise partners who embed product owners directly into your Jira boards. A schedule that stalls that feedback loop undermines not just goodwill, but renewal options and the CFO's forecast. Studies that treat external stakeholders as spectators won't capture these high-stakes dependencies. Methodology becomes the next battleground. At the top of your hierarchy sit randomized field experiments, rare gems that speak with near-clinical precision. Below them lie longitudinal quasi-experiments with control groups and statistical controls mitigating selection bias. Next come meta-analyses and large multi-firm surveys, broad in scope but occasionally fuzzy on causality. Further down are narrative case studies, consultant white papers, and anecdotes, still useful but weaker for making large-scale decisions. Individual testimonials, Glassdoor rants, and LinkedIn threads provide color but are hardly compasses for a multi-million dollar bet. Declaring this evidence ladder now inoculates you against the inevitable says who when presenting to a board that measures everything in petabytes. Malik flags a new Stanford paper on hybrid adoption across 7 SaaS companies over 18 months, while Elena points out that only 2 of those companies rely on customer-facing co-development, and just 1 mirrors your sprint length. The hierarchy is already at work, winnowing noise before the real debate starts. Night falls, the cleaning crew rolls by, and the bunker grows still. You and your colleagues match each morale construct to hard metrics, align those metrics with credible studies, and set them against the reality of global time zones, sprint cycles, and revenue-critical client work. Tomorrow, you will dissect the trade-offs among 2 remote days, 2-hour flex windows, or 4-day weeks, but tonight's job is to ground every discussion. Even words like cohesion and vitality now have operational definitions. Every data point will soon wear a clear label, gold, silver, or bronze, based on its methodological heft. You shut down the wall displays, let the bunker lights dim, and head for the foyer. Vitality is not just a statistic. It's what fuels these late nights and the ambition driving you forward. Tomorrow, you will turn evidence into an actionable pilot that might reshape how 700 people spend their day. For now, you choose rest and let the data wait, fully aware of how much hinges on its interpretation. Dawn seeps through the bay window slats of the evidence bunker as you and the team gather around a single slide titled simply, 2 Remote Days. In a company that prizes elegant code, the proposal is almost minimalist. Monday and Friday at home, Tuesday through Thursday on campus. Yet the data behind that sparseness reads like an epic. 8 flagship studies now glow across the wall, each one offering a different lens on the question, what actually happens when people spend part of the week away from the office? The first major clue comes from a sweeping experiment inside the U.S. Patent Office. Over 1,600 knowledge workers drew a lottery ticket that either kept them in office or allowed 2 remote days. 18 months later, engagement scores had climbed 6 points and individual productivity nudged up 5%. Attrition fell by more than a third, gains traced to a surprising culprit, energy. Commute time dropped an average of 8.6 hours per week, which people reinvested in deeper work blocks and sometimes extra sleep. If that sounds disconnected from software sprints, the next study lands closer to home. 7 tech firms, all running agile cadences, random assigned 3,200 engineers to a Tuesday through Thursday anchor schedule. Sprint velocity held steady, but bug fix time fell 12%, largely because midweek co-location preserved pair programming rituals, while Monday and Friday solitude allowed undisturbed refactoring. engagement rose 9 points, and voluntary quits fell 28%. Engineers spoke of battery recharge Mondays and focus Fridays with near religious fervor. Not every chart curves skyward. A large productivity suite maker saw its social graph density shrink by a quarter on hybrid schedules, with junior hires losing 17% of their senior engineer touch points. Structured collab hours repaired some of the damage, but the lesson was clear. Autonomy can sever the invisible threads that speed up learning. A global meta-synthesis of 42 quasi-experiments echoed this theme, showing that moving to 2 remote days lifts self-reported work-life balance by 14% and drops emotional exhaustion by 11%, but also triggers a 7% drop in promotion rates for those who work from home more than 40% of the time. Managers, it seems, still rely on hallway serendipity for spotting who's lead ready. Zoom in on equity and nuance abounds. A major Australian bank found that 2,700 caregivers enjoyed morale gains twice as high as their peers, thanks to flexible commutes. At the same time, new hires, especially those from underrepresented groups, felt off stage without casual introductions and spontaneous chats. Early attrition ticked upward until the bank mandated in-person mentorship days. One European telecom showed that customer satisfaction scores stayed flat only when same-day meeting windows and dedicated on-call rotations were guaranteed. Remove that guardrail and satisfaction faltered within a quarter. The parallel for your business is obvious. Clients accustomed to real-time access can't be left guessing which day their product owner will pick up the phone. A longitudinal study worth its weight in predictive gold tracked a cohort of hybrid teams for 3 full years. Year 1 sparkled, well-being soared, turnover plummeted, profits held steady. Year 2 stayed solid. By year 3, the teams that invested in remote rituals, camera-on stand-ups, buddy systems, quarterly on-sites, sustained their gains, while those that treated hybrid as a set-and-forget perk drifted back to baseline and saw trust measures crack. The short case of Nimbus Analytics in Toronto brings these findings to life. Nimbus watched quits fall from 16 to 10% after switching to Monday and Friday remote, perfectly mirroring academic predictions on commute savings. Yet junior developers, often recruited from coding boot camps, struggled to land promotions because their heads-down workdays never brushed against senior architects in hallway conversations. When HR data revealed a skew favoring those within a short radius of HQ, Nimbus introduced Mentor Mondays and a digital praise wall. 12 months later, that equity gap closed, but the company still points to the episode as proof that visibility is a design variable, not a given. Back in the bunker, you align these lessons with your own survey findings. Commute fatigue and emotional exhaustion are the loudest complaints. 2 remote days promise to cut drive time by more than 70 hours per quarter and reduce burnout by double digits. Sprints should remain healthy if you safeguard Tuesday through Thursday rituals. The data even hints that client satisfaction can hold steady, provided you map out coverage for urgent escalations. Yet no single study lets leadership off the hook for equity. Caregivers stand to gain the most, but new hires and underrepresented employees face heightened visibility threats. Without upfront investments in structured mentorship, transparent performance rubrics, and on-site onboarding tracks, hybrid can become a perk for some and a career trap for others. Proximity bias also carries managerial overhead. Your already stressed middle managers must now shepherd inclusion, manage distributed calendars, and uphold psychological safety. Meanwhile, client responsiveness, the firm's pride, demands a clear on-call model that covers remote days. The telecom example shows it can work, but only if coverage is codified, not assumed. When the last study fades from the screen, the composite forecast flickers to life. Engagement up, attrition down, sprint velocity holding steady, and client metrics stable, so long as clear guardrails exist around anchor days, inclusion, and on-call coverage. It's a greenish-yellow light, signaling both promise and risk. You exhale, letting the weight of a dozen data sets settle into a design spec that might revive the buzz without unraveling the culture that once made buzz effortless. Outside, commuters inch along Highway 101, unaware that the very necessity of their rush hour drive is now under empirical review. For the first time in months, the decision feels less like a gamble and more like a cautious yet confident prototype, backed by statistics, cautionary tales, and a roadmap that honors the complex lives moving behind each ID badge. The poker chip clatter of keyboards has barely begun when the evidence bunker fills again, lit by a single phrase stretched across the wraparound screen. Arrive anytime 8 to 10, depart anytime 4 to 6. This second schedule option looks deceptively simple. Just stretch the bookends of the day. Yet the scroll of studies Malik calls up suggests otherwise. In knowledge work, when people clock in can be as potent as where they sit. You ask the team to picture the sales floor at 8:07 a.m. under the proposed plan. A few early bird engineers might already hover by the espresso machine, hashing out CI/CD improvements. A product manager, parent of twin toddlers, won't badge in until 9:55, cheeks still flushed from the drop-off sprint. By noon, the building hums at near capacity. By 4:02, it begins to thin like coastal fog. The question is whether that shared core, noon to 4, can sustain agile stand-ups, pair programming, client demos, and whatever production emergencies arise. The first research tile reveals a decade-long meta-analysis of schedule control trials spanning 5 continents and 45,000 workers. Give employees even modest freedom over arrival and departure, it shows, and work-family conflict drops by a fifth, morning mindset perks up nearly as much, and cortisol spikes flatten. Yet once shared overlap dips below 5 hours, performance benefits unravel. Code reviews stall, tickets idle, hallway handoffs vanish. Noon to 4 yields a precarious 4 hours on the clock together, just shy of that threshold. A more granular lens appears in Microsoft's Chronotype initiative, which quietly monitored 20,000 engineers. Early larks wrote cleaner code around 8:30, night owls peaked near 10:15, and defects fell 6% when people could align with their internal clocks. But as soon as team overlap slipped under 4.7 hours, cross-team pull requests clogged and agile velocity dipped. Elena points to a cybersecurity firm in Austin that hard-locked an 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. overlap. Mean time to resolution plummeted from 58 to 48 minutes because an early riser crew triaged overnight alerts before the main shift arrived. A contrasting story comes from fintech unicorn Everglide, which bragged about no mandatory clock. Overlap shrank to barely 3 hours, stand-ups became pre-recorded videos, and everything seemed fine, until a regulatory fiasco surfaced. Spread across scattered schedules, teams took 2 hours to resolve a bug that eroded client trust, forcing leaders to abandon the experiment. Trade-offs sharpen under Agile's intense cadence. Daily stand-ups thrive on brevity, so staggering arrival times can force double stand-ups or drag part of the team from their prime coding window. Backlog refinement might survive asynchronously, but live demo days draw power from real-time applause. A half-full room at 9 a.m. or a half-dozing crowd at 5:30 can dull the buzz that once defined the culture. Escalations pose another red flag. The Cornell DevOps study shows urgency demands at least 4 hours of simultaneous coverage with on-call engineers. That can still work here if an early riser triages pings from Singapore, but only if on-call rosters are spelled out. Otherwise, tickets age like milk left on the counter. Autonomy offers clear gains for caregivers. Arriving after drop-off or leaving by pickup can reduce stress, and employees sensitive to noise or long commutes also benefit from emptier trains. Yet for the 14% who drive in from distant exurbs, a 2-hour flex window barely dents 90-minute commutes. New hires can suffer too. Show up at 8 a.m. and you may wander a half-deserted floor until everyone rolls in. SentinelForge solved that by pairing each newcomer with a flex buddy who mirrored arrival times for the first 2 months, boosting retention among juniors. Proximity bias mutates here. Early arrivals enjoy unscripted CEO chats over coffee while the late crowd nets the boss's ear at day's end. Without a plan, FaceTime turns into lopsided access. A European telco required team leads to rotate arrival blocks each month, proving performance is not about beating the dawn or burning the midnight oil. CFO Marcus lingers by the door, crunching real estate numbers. A 2-hour flex cuts the midday peak from 92 to 78% capacity, delaying expansions. But if half the desks sit empty too long, the specter of building bloat stirs. The question of vitality, physical and mental looms. Some gain 38 minutes of extra sleep, measurably lowering stress markers. Others slide into later hours, risking a dreaded 14-hour slack cycle that only abates when explicit silent times are declared. Stepping to the whiteboard, you sketch a fraction. Autonomy over overlap. Too little freedom and it's the status quo. Too little overlap and you invite chaos. The sweet spot hovers around 4.5 to 5 shared hours, cemented by explicit norms, a single stand-up, rotating on-call coverage, and a rule that code reviews posted after 6 p.m. can wait. Before you wrap, the risk matrix shimmers to life. Morale sits at amber edging toward green, collaboration at solid amber, escalation response green if properly rostered, and inclusivity a patchwork of solutions demanding careful mentoring. By the time the bunker empties, that fraction remains on the glass, an enduring reminder that granting people control of their clocks requires discipline around how those clocks intersect. The ceiling lights blink to life, and a new title glows on the bunker wall. 4 days, 10 hours? Can we fold a work week like origami? Alex cues a highlight reel from Iceland, shot during the still dark Reykjavik winter. Municipal employees pour out of offices on Thursday evenings, scarves flapping, faces lit by the thrill of a bonus day that suddenly belongs to them. The trial, run between 2015 and 2019, is now legend. Absenteeism down, well-being up, public services delivered without a hiccup. Those images have fueled 1,000 LinkedIn threads and more than a few Slack DMs in this very building. Could we do Fridays off too? The camera then cuts to interviews recorded 9 months later. A school administrator confesses she now keeps paracetamol in her desk. The 9th and 10th consecutive hours at work leave her head buzzing. A social services caseworker admits client callbacks sometimes slide to Monday because Thursday evening no longer exists. The miracle, it turns out, acquired hairline cracks the longer it stayed on the shelf. Data scrolls down the bunker screen. In months 1 through 4, job satisfaction scores jump 14% and self-reported stress plummets. By month 6, concentration lapses rise, rework ticks up, and unit productivity settles almost exactly where it started. Elena flips the feed to the United Kingdom, where 24 mid-sized firms ran a highly publicized 4-day pilot. Headlines screamed success when 92% of employees begged to keep the schedule. Dig deeper and you see a tale of two cohorts. Designers, data analysts, and UX writers flourished. Their work packages could stretch or compress without catastrophe. But client-facing support teams watched ticket queues that usually vanished by sundown linger until Monday. A Manchester SaaS outfit, one that, like us, promises 7-day uptime, added a redundant Saturday squad to plug the gap, and the savings that had made the 4-day plan so seductive promptly vanished. Malik summons a heat map of a Boston ad tech company's internal error tracker. In weeks 1 through 8 of its compressed schedule, bug counts hold level. Weeks 9 through 12 reveal a faint swell, nothing alarming, until the second quarterly release collides with the new hours. 10-hour sprint days meet endgame crunch, and merge conflicts blossom like algae after rain. Senior engineers, drained by 12 straight story points, defer peer reviews. The company salvages the pilot by carving a midday dark hour to shut down Slack pings so people can breathe, but CTOs concede that energy, not time, became the scarcest resource. Everyone remembers the climate survey comment about family getting the burnt ends. A compressed week promises the opposite. A whole juicy Friday to savor. But where do those extra hours come from? You sketch a curve on the glass, cognitive acuity on the vertical axis, hours worked on the horizontal. For most knowledge workers, performance plateaus after hour 6 and dips after hour 8, meaning a 10-hour day races straight into that downslope. Coffee can mask it, but tiny slips accumulate, a misplaced semicolon, a tense support email, a misread requirement. Priya, ever the guardian of customer trust, notes that a 4-day week compresses client coverage by 20%. An irate Singapore bank pinging at 6 a.m. on Friday will face voicemail unless someone volunteers overtime, which resurrects burnout under a new banner. One Denver gaming studio that proudly posted its Free Fridays banner survived only by instituting rolling off days, fragmenting team collaboration until they retreated to a more mundane hybrid plan. Yet nobody can deny that initial wave of euphoria. Sleep scores soar when everyone claims a three-day weekend, parents attend school field trips, and hobbyists finish novels. Luis imagines bigger blocks for refactoring and fewer midweek context switches, a potential forge for craftsmanship if minds stay sharp. That promise dims when the lens widens to equity. Caregivers gain precious family time, but employees with chronic conditions, migraines, back pain, report flare-ups during 10-hour marathons. New hires, especially those accustomed to learning through osmosis, lose a day of casual exposure to senior colleagues. Affinity group lunches and mentorship circles already scramble calendars. Repossess a weekday and something valuable will fall off the edge. Marcus, running budget models, notes that closing campus each Friday could trim utility costs and postpone a parking lot expansion. But any savings fade if you must staff a hotline or pay time and a half to volunteers. With arguments swirling, you pull up the weighted decision matrix set days ago. Morale gets 40% weight, collaboration 25, client responsiveness 20, operational feasibility 15. For the compressed week, morale shines at 82, collaboration slides to 60, client coverage struggles at 55, and operational feasibility lands at 64. Tally those numbers and the plan scores 62 out of 100, promising, yet limping. Two remote days leads at 78 and the flex window claims 71. Silence falls, because numbers only sharpen intuition, they don't settle it. Still, hybrid stands tallest, with the least trade-off pain. Maya's face appears in a scheduled check-in. You pivot the camera so she can see the matrix. She nods, repeating the mantra that ends all speculation, truth, not trendy. The four-day dream may return with sturdier guardrails, but for now, you dim the screen and let the corridor's neon hum wash over the moment. Tomorrow will bring the final rehearsal deck and a boardroom pitch. Tonight, that matrix glows in memory. A compass with sharp edges, pointing toward a schedule designed to revive the company's buzz without mortgaging reliability. Outside, Thursday traffic crawls along, unaware that Friday is still on the table, for better, for worse, and for 700 people poised to learn their newly shaped week. The boardroom is cool enough to keep anxiety taut. 12 directors, 2 venture observers, and a wellness coach turned advisor sit beneath lights that make every gesture look cinematic. Maya has already framed the problem. Now she tilts the screen toward you. One slide, midnight blue, holds a single statement in luminous type. Pilot a Tuesday through Thursday anchor week, with Monday and Friday remote for roles not bound to client sites or data centers. Beneath the sentence glows the start date, January 8th, 08 Pacific, and its sunset clause, December 20th, 17. You breathe in, switch to narrative mode, and begin. Hybrid 2 remote days, you say, is not a perk. It is an engineered response to commute fatigue, meeting sprawl, and creeping attrition. But the design only works if we neutralize 4 predictable failure modes: proximity bias, social fragmentation, security drift, and managerial overload. In addressing guardrails, the first concern is proximity bias, that subtle gravity pulling opportunities toward the faces most seen in person. From day one, every recurring meeting longer than 15 minutes includes a rotating facilitator who confirms who is remote, who is on site, and calls on virtual hands before physical ones. Cameras stay on whenever bandwidth allows, and slides become shared digital canvases rather than wall-only visuals. Promotion packets prompt managers to cite tangible work artifacts beyond in-person impressions. To foster unplanned encounters, each anchor week ends with a 30-minute serendipity shuffle, pairing remote and in-office colleagues for open-ended chats. The algorithm gently biases these matches so juniors meet seniors they haven't yet crossed paths with. Next comes social cohesion. The risk is a slow dilution of the buzz the company once took for granted. Quarterly compound on-sites bring scrum trains to campus for hack days, demo-thons, and hallway run-ins that no algorithm can replicate. Between those gatherings, squads keep a consistent digital rhythm. Daily Slack huddles at 10:05, persistent Miro boards that replace sticky note walls, and a monthly open mic lightning talk carousel on Zoom. These rituals, adapted but never abandoned, preserve the collective hum. Security must scale with mobility. the chief information security officer's slides show how Monday and Friday remote work simply extends zero trust architecture across an expanded perimeter. Every packet travels through posture-aware gateways, and a purple team drill in week two will test how well each role defends against simulated spear phishing. Any slip triggers remedial micro-learning. The system might feel strict, but freedom without safety is frailty in disguise. Managerial load is the final hurdle. Middle managers juggle sprint burndowns, OKRs, and feedback cycles. To prevent burnout, they get outcome-based scorecards that auto-populate from Jira and Salesforce, sparing them tedious manual tracking. A manager concierge detail in PeopleOps assumes the administrative shocks of seat reservations, extra monitors, and on-site travel. A Slack channel called Lead Lab remains staffed 12 hours a day by HR partners and agile coaches, so any manager can drop in without fearing hidden judgment. You pause for a temperature check, eyes remain engaged, notepads poised. It is time to show how success or failure will be clear. Engagement pulses fire at baseline, then months 3, 6, 9, and 12, each time aiming for at least 70% response within 2 days. Metrics on sprint velocity, defect rates, and mean time to recovery feed continuously from GitLab and PagerDuty. Client health arrives via NPS and renewal probabilities, piped through the same data warehouse that supports forecasting. All this rolls into a public dashboard visible to the entire company, with three non-negotiable targets: an 8-point engagement lift, no more than a 5% dip in sprint velocity, and client satisfaction stable or better. Miss any two targets for two consecutive quarters, and leadership can abort or reshape the pilot before December. Change management, you caution, is where even brilliant pilots falter. Within hours, Maya will record a brief video in the lobby where the company's first shipping crate once stood, explaining why the pilot matters and how it will unfold. Every people manager across three time zones hosts a squad huddle with the same deck, adapted for local idioms. Over the first week, role-specific clinics tackle security readiness, agile ceremony adjustments, and client coverage changes. Each afternoon, an office hours live, Zoom offers a direct line to the pilot's architects. By week 6, the data starts to flow, shared warts and all, because no one follows an experiment they cannot trust. A former Fortune 50 CIO among the directors asks the inevitable question, "What if people want to stay home more days? Is that a slippery slope?" Maya reminds him that the pilot's premise is commute relief, not pure preference, with a clear timeline. If the data pleads for further expansion, leadership will consider it. If it shows erosion, they will pivot. Either way, the decision rests on evidence, not hunches. Silence settles, signaling thought rather than resistance. The electronic vote lights the table's edge, green diodes in succession. Motion passes unanimously. Out in the hallway, Maya meets you with a low but buoyant voice. "We built buzz once with proximity. Now we'll build it with intentionality." She checks her watch, 7:28 a.m., the same time that kicked off this entire odyssey, and smiles. When the elevator opens, the Atrium Coffee Bar is already serving double espressos to engineers who will soon recapture two mornings at their own kitchen tables. The pilot charter is signed, and the future of the buzz now hinges on disciplined freedom, transparent dashboards, and leaders who see that work is no longer just a place or a time slot, but an evolving design problem. You step into the elevator, carrying three reflections for the road. Treat flexibility as a product built on user stories. Use evidence to turn fear into curiosity, and keep revisiting cultural code before it accumulates hidden debt. The doors close, leaving you with the sense that the next era of collaboration has quietly begun. Thank you for choosing Astor Publishing.